Hello and welcome to Deep Impact, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we dive deep into Wildbo's most reflective work 5 years on. Coming up next is Elliot Diebold.
And that was Ruben Morehouse.
And we are back to talk about Malfeasance 11.x. It's another Histories, Elliot. Hooray!
Woo!
I love the Histories arcs.
I love this.
I think the Histories arcs are my favorite arcs. I mean, already interlude arcs are great, but Histories just, like, takes it to another level. I don't know what it is, but it's so satisfying.
Wait, so you mean chapters, or...?
Sorry, yes, I do mean chapters.
Okay. Yeah. No, I agree. Like, I love these full cast ones as well. It's great to sort of hit us really hard with a couple of great and varying point of views. So
yeah.
I know. Let's just get into it and talk about them.
So this interlude opens with a redneck family preparing for dinner, and it's about 7 or 8 lines in before we realize we are following Midge.
Yeah, I like how this is not kept for too long. I think most people who are, you know, smarter than me probably picked exactly who it was after the description of Ma'am.
Mm.
But yeah, like it's sort of good how we set this tone of like weird hills have eyes type stuff, and then you just straight away they're like Wobbo's like, yep, this is Midge.
Yeah. And it's very hills have eyes, isn't it? We'll get into the specifics of how horrible this family is in a second, but even just the way it's written, it really goes out of its way to make the reader uncomfortable. Uncomfortable is too weak a word. Like, actively grossed out, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, at least for me, this got under my skin probably more than anything else impact. Mm. It'd be right up there with the fight against Pose in Craig's house.
Because that
was so gross. But, like, I blame the X-Files for this, but like the whole creepy inbred family out somewhere remote is the scariest horror trope for me.
Yeah.
And so like this the opening to this chapter was just playing to all the right things to make me so intensely uncomfortable compared to, like, you know, the same amount of horror with a different topic.
Yeah, and it's quite fun that this exists. I mean, like, maybe we talked about this when Midge first appeared in the story, I don't remember, but obviously Pact is a world where all these monsters are real, and Wildbo has found a way to turn what is really a monster that is just humans into a kind of supernatural force in such an interesting way. I really love it, and I really love how much we find out about Midge here and how many questions are answered and also raised about how the whole Midge thing works, I guess.
Definitely. Because, I mean, it's something, like, as I sort of mentioned, you know, we talked about The Hills Have Eyes, X-Files had that one infamous episode, Supernatural's had some great ones.
Yeah.
There's something inherently creepy just about the concept of people out in remote areas who have become slightly less human,
yeah.
I guess. And that's exactly what Midge is playing to, you know, it's, I hate it. It's so good.
Yeah, I think there'd be an interesting Monster Corner in a future episode maybe about talking about the concept of the redneck family as a horror trope and how that's originated. Because it really has only come in from, like, the cinema age, surely.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's definitely, like, I feel like it's an Uncanny Valley thing. Like, the fact that they are mostly human, but somehow, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, so back to Midge. She is being forced to kind of watch over her brothers. They're babies, but they and her as well kind of are basically Neanderthal in nature, I would say. They kind of give me definitely this Neanderthal vibe. Midge really does not give a shit about them and pays them only the barest amount of attention.
The description of these brothers, again, this chapter just really got under my skin. I was very uncomfortable reading about all this. It's so good.
Yeah. And then there's this bit where, so later on we find out that there are these captives that are being abused and then going to be eaten by this family. And we get like 3 or 4 lines of them kind of reacting, but without Midge commenting on them. So it's just kind of lines like, shh, hey, what's she doing? But no attribution, no nothing that says the girl said or anything like that. It's just kind of a disembodied voice. And it very much continues this, like, what the fuck's happening in this scene until we actually find out that they're there.
Yeah, my first thought was that somebody was, like, watching this scene through time and we were seeing the actual POV. But Yeah, and of course, the reality is so much worse. but I really like this I guess impaired viewpoint we have of Midge, because it lets us it lets Wabo do lots of really clever stuff of expositing between the lines. So we're left to sort of pick up the pieces that she misses, but it's written in a very clever way, so that's quite easy to do. It's really fun to read like that when it's done well, which I think it is here.
Yeah.
And it also keeps us from hating Midge as much. Like I just mostly feel sorry for Midge, and I mean this, if we just hated her and if she was just the worst, this would be a lot less engaging to read, whereas as it is, you're just kind of like, oh, this sucks.
Yes, I definitely agree with you. And I think we're going to talk about this a bit more over the course of the chapter, but Midge is, as another, definitely a product of a family and a world that has failed her, right?
Yeah.
She really is, as another, like a really big 5-year-old, and that's basically all she is. And so, you know, obviously she does some horrifying things, but you kind of can't blame her for them too much, right?
Well, she hasn't had an opportunity to do better, really.
Yeah. I want to pull out this line, because I really like the kind of the little trick in the writing with it, where Midge prodded Biff, one of her baby brothers, with the bone until Biff tipped over. His head cracked against the wooden slats of the crib, his neck finding a funny angle. He continued chewing on his bottom lip, staring absently in her general direction. I really love this, because the line, like, I kind of, it's a bit of a trope in things like this where we know something's going to go wrong, and the trope of, like, kids playing together and one of them accidentally, like, killing the other one is something that I would totally expect to be in a story like this. And when we get to the line, his head cracked against the wooden slats of the crib, his neck finding a funny angle, like, that's how a young child processes somebody breaking their neck. Like, that is the line that I could see as, you know, Midge has accidentally just broken her baby brother's neck. And so in your head, when you're reading that, you're kind of like, oh, shit, this is what's going to go wrong and you know, stuff's going to go bad from here. But then we get to the next line where he just kind of continues absentmindedly chewing away, staring into space. And it's so great, because it takes you on this, like, quick emotional whiplash journey that really demonstrates how off this family is. Like, oh, this baby's neck is just broken. Oh, no, wait, he's fine. And it's like, why? How is that possible?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's worse. I agree. It's a great little bit of writing that just sends you on a journey and really starts to escalate it. Like, these aren't just physical or externally physical abnormalities in this family. Like, this is proper biological, possibly even supernatural level, you know, abnormalities.
Yeah, definitely. So Midge finally kind of takes note of the captives in the room. They're there, and it's going to get worse for them. Yeah.
Yeah, there are. I mean, yeah, they're not in for a good time.
No. And it's pretty horrifying, right? It's some real Hills Have Eyes, Deliverance-style horror movie shit.
Yeah.
They're here to be abused and then eaten, which is gross.
Yeah, actually, I want to pull out one line that sort of comes out of Midge's interactions with these hostages. So one of the hostages is smiling at Midge, and Midge says, Midge thinks, Midge didn't trust smiles. Smiling was what you did when you hurt people, or sometimes when Pa got his food, or Mam got her Pa. A rare thing. For Midge, it mostly meant being hurt. And then there's a bit where she starts to interact with them, and she goes on to sort of think, she didn't stop or slow down. When she was right next to him, she jabbed, striking him in the corner of the eye. Ow, fuck. What the fuck? What is wrong with you? Midge stared at him. The anger was more familiar. Comfortable. And I mean, yeah, like, I'm so impressed that in the middle of all this overwhelming Hills Have Eyes style horror that's making me intensely uncomfortable, Walbo's managed to, like, fit in a bit of heartbreaking sympathy for Midge.
Yeah.
Well, like, I'm so impressed that he managed to have another emotion kind of break through when I was so intensely uncomfortable already.
Yeah.
That really just sums up this whole segment for me, which is like, wow, this is horrible, but poor Midge.
Yeah, definitely. So Midge kind of shows these captives that they're basically going to be killed. and they manage to trick her and take her as a hostage, trying to use her to escape, which is a good plan in theory, but it doesn't go very well.
It's foreshadowing Eva. No. Yeah, I mean, I don't quite understand the, like, mechanics or the physics behind these collars.
So as I understand it, they you know, they click on, and then the release latch for them is in a place that needs to be accessed by kind of jabbing a knife through a slit in the collars, which would release them, but also will stab somebody with a knife, or can only really be released if there's no head inside the collar.
Yeah, okay. Like, I understood that part of it, but I didn't quite understand, like, how that works in practice. But I guess that makes sense if it's, like, if you have to jab it from the inside out, like, directly on. Okay.
Mm.
Okay. Sorry.
No, yeah. A little aside. Yeah. Yeah, it's horrifying. And yeah, like you said, like, you can't help but feel terribly for Midge here. Even as she basically becomes the kind of monster that Blake was terrified of when he was in the Abyss.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially here we find out that she's apparently basically the size of an adult, but she's only 5.
Yeah.
Assuming she wasn't wrong about that, but yeah. I don't think she is. Seems like a point that the story's making.
Yeah, she's only 5. And yeah, and she does grow up over the course of this chapter. We kind of skip through time a bit, but we never really see her mentally progress beyond where she is right now, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, like, it has me wondering, do you actually age in the Abyss?
Yeah, if
you
true. Go in maybe she kid? Is still 5. It's interesting because I went back and read when she was introduced, and there's no mention of how old they think she is. So she could still be physically 5. It's kind of hard to tell, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, so, either way, she's huge and she's a tank.
Yes, she is. She is being held hostage by this girl and kind of gets overwhelmed by being so close to her and always having last pick of the food, and so just decides to take a pre-dinner snack and bite a huge chunk out of this girl that is holding onto her.
Yeah, so greedy, Midge. Come on.
Yeah. And it's something that's interesting to me about this is Midge kind of thinks about how even to her family she is odd, right? And it kind of started me thinking about how somebody who is basically just a human, how do they become an other, right? Because even before Midge goes to the Abyss, she still seems to have some other-ish qualities, right? She gets stabbed here and is relatively unflinching towards that stab, which felt very otherish to me, right?
Yeah.
And she seems to think, or she's got the impression from her parents, that she was kind of born different, which implies that there's some kind of genetic, I don't know, mutation component that results in somebody having, I guess, a higher propensity to turn into an other. I don't know what to make of that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
No, I mean, there's definitely, like, some general trends in their family. Like, the boys seem to be really skinny, whereas the girls are quite, like, large.
Yeah.
But there's obviously, like, variation too. And, yeah, like, I don't know. I think you're right. There's this sort of slide into more otherness that they're going through. I mean, it takes me back to that that short story Wobbo wrote about, like, the guy who was studying subhumans.
Yeah. Yeah, and so actually I was rereading those after I read this chapter, and there is some stuff in one of the chapters of Poke, as Wobbo has referred to it, that kind of talks about this as well, where like some of these families that he've studied has become more other as they've had like a seventh son of a seventh son or a third daughter of a third daughter, kind of important milestones of children that kind of lead to those being more special and therefore being a little bit more other. And so that's possibly what's going on here with Midge as well.
Oh man, I need to read the rest of that. Also, I'm like 8 chapters behind in Ward, so I gotta catch up. Wobbo writes too many.
Yeah, yeah. It's all his patrons. All his patrons keeping him going.
Yeah, okay. No, but like, yeah, I do think there's a sort of exploration in this Midge section of the chapter on that blurry line between human and other, because she is like an Abyssborn, I think, is the term that people started using in the story.
I think the subhuman is referred, like, she's referred to as a subhuman, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but I mean, now she's closer to, like, just being a boogeyman. What?
Sure.
But, you know, she started off not quite human anyway. So, yeah, like, I think there's some interesting explorations on that being done right here, but we'll talk about that more towards the end, I think.
Yeah, I think this whole chapter is exploring the line between, and I guess the whole story, is exploring the line between human and other, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is one of the things that this chapter is really doing, is starting to think about, we've seen this explored through Blake, where he is an other, but he still retains aspects of his humanity, and is kind of in constant struggle between those two. And I think that's what this chapter is doing, is starting to introduce us a bit more aggressively to the idea of, well, no, this isn't just Blake, he's not a special case. All the others are kind of like this, where they are, to an extent, dealing with very human struggles that are just applied in a otherish way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, Mam pulls Midge away from all of their food and locks her in the dark shed, where she kind of learns to survive by hunting on rats and eventually crawls further and further back into the shed until she finds herself in the abyss.
I love how this is done, because this is like one of our first cases of seeing like one of the more benign ways to slip through the cracks. Like,
yeah.
Mags and Blake had, you know, fairly dramatic fallings out with the universe, whereas Midge is basically only connected to her family. And as that connection presumably degraded as she spent more time in the shed, she just sort of slowly slipped from one dark place to another.
Yeah.
I mean, interestingly for her, the abyss is almost an improvement in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
From where she was.
Well, there's better food for her to hunt other than just rats. Yeah,
exactly. There's also a nice little touch where, you know, she talks about how she, you know, grows and escalates her violence in the abyss.
Yeah.
And she mentions that the first time she killed more than one person, it was like a couple, like a pa and a mem is what she calls them.
Mm.
And I mean, I just love that as a perfect little detail, because of course she'd be more violent towards what she perceives to be like a couple that maybe resembled her family to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder how much that plays into it. It must, surely. Although she seemed to have a pretty good relationship with her dad. Just not.
Oh, yeah, I imagine there was a feeling of betrayal after he, you know, didn't help much to lock her in.
Fair. Yeah, and it's interesting to me that we see time pass in here, and this does raise the question, as you touched on before, do people age in the abyss, right? Because we don't know how old, or not old, old isn't, I guess, the right word. We don't know when Midge was first kind of put in the shed and when she entered into the abyss. We don't really have a clear idea of the timeline there, but we do see that her pa has aged by maybe 20 or 30 years at least the next time they see each other, and she seems to have not aged that much. So there's definitely some age shenanigans going on, I would say.
Yeah, well, I think she mentions her brothers being like halfway to being adults, which I think implies that maybe it's like 10-ish or so years.
Mm.
Yeah, but yeah, it's interesting whether she would have changed biologically in the abyss. And also, you know, given that she was already the size of an adult at 5 years old, like how much that would matter for her anyway.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think she goes through like normal like puberty and growth in that way.
No, but I actually think she's probably bigger than an adult now. Like I get the sense from when she
does seem to have grown since she went into the shed, I think.
Yeah.
I also like how different the abyss is in Midge's section.
Yeah.
Like it reminds me, like the faceless woman said she was from a forest.
Mm.
I think at one point Green Eyes mentioned she like found a mole when she was down there. Like I like the idea that the abyss isn't all the drains like that, and that's why not everyone calls it the drains or whatever. It's like all these little zones of simple themes that have been gleaned from the real world, like I guess the faintest imprints of form from like above.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Ava mentioned that Andy had said last chapter that the whole world was at one point abyss.
Yeah.
And I like this as the kind of, it gives the impression that the abyss is what kind of gestates some of the things that we see in the real world. And these are the early prototype versions of them, I guess.
Or it might be, like, yeah, as you move further down into the chaos and you're sort of below more of the meaning of the world, it's whatever's strongest above it that, that permeates the most.
Interesting.
So, you know,
yeah,
the faceless woman coming from a forest, it was probably a rural area that sort of had more forest. Like, the mall, I don't know. I don't know how that works. Maybe there was a town that, you know, had a big mall that was at the center of it. I don't know. The drains, obviously, Toronto, I guess, is known in the world of Pact for its great sewer system. I don't know.
I mean, there this could is... be also, it could also be that these places are just places in the way that Midge and Blake slipped through the cracks. These places are places that have slipped through the cracks, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A forest that, I don't know, burned down, or a mall that, you know, people stopped going to, and it eventually closed.
Yeah, I like that better.
Then, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I prefer that, actually. I'm going to go with that.
Okay, cool. Headcanoned. So Midge basically stays in here hunting people and becoming one of the scariest monsters in her version of the Abyss for a while, until eventually the shed door opens again and people come for Midge. She kills a fair few of them before they eventually manage to bind her and get her to agree to the seal.
Yeah, so I guess I'm assuming these people were targeting her. From the way it all goes down, because they seem prepared for her. So I guess these are the people who come down to the Abyss and pull people out.
Well, they have her family. They hunt down her family, which means I'm kind of unsure if it's they're looking for her specifically and then found the family as a means of tracking her down, or they found the family and took care of them, and then Midge was just kind of an incident.
Well, they seem to be aware of her
enough
to know her name immediately. So I think and her pa didn't even notice. So like that seems to imply to me that if they knew that much, they maybe were coming specifically for her. Like they were so prepared for it. Also, like, you know, she'd been moving around for years. It's a bit weird to me that she would just reappear in the shed.
No,
like,
I don't
know if that's how the Abyss quite works.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, nobody opened the shed door for 10 years or whatever. Like, if you know, if her Mum had just come and opened the door, would she reappear there? Like, I don't think so. So
yeah, fair.
I have a feeling they sort of came for her.
Yeah.
But yeah, she just hulks out on them. Like they come to regret it, I reckon.
They really were not prepared for Midge. I think they heard that she was 5 years old and expected something different. Because she rips some of their heads off of their bodies with her brute strength.
And then throws those heads at people with such force that it knocks them over.
Yeah.
She's pretty nuts. I mean, I love how it also takes a lot more, like, symbols and words to control her than they expect. Like, she gets a few more kills in than they're expecting
because
she's not as affected by words. And I like that as a representation of how out of the system she is, both from the Abyss and before the Abyss.
Yeah.
That it just those things just don't affect her as much when she first gets out.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's great. It's great kind of flavor to add to her. And so this is the story of her first binding, and then we kind of jump ahead to Blake and company summoning her and telling her to guard the outside of the house because things are about to pop off.
Yeah, so and this is a bit where I really started to see, because at first I was like, why are we having a Midge interlude? This is kind of random. And then, of course, it's because we're seeing some of the others that are the Cabal is getting together to keep the house safe.
Yeah.
I mean, Midge seems like a smart choice to me, honestly. And she actually has a look at Blake. And I want to call this out, because just like over in Parahumans Land, I'm very excited to see our protagonist from someone else's perspective. Not the least of which, because, you know, between his lack of reflection and lack of ability to self-reflect, we don't get to see him do it very often.
Yeah.
Midge looks at Blake and thinks, his face crawled with branches. His hair was so grimy, it didn't move when his head did. When he blinked, 6 different beady eyes that peered between branches also blinked.
Yeah.
Slightly out of time.
Yeah, that's more pairs of eyes than we thought he had last time, right?
Well, I think the last proper eye update we got, he only had one. Like, remember in the Abyss, he was down to one eye?
Well, true.
Now he's got more than 6, so it's an improvement. He's time's running out for Blake to figure out how he's going to handle all this other stuff, I think. He's looking very othery right now.
Yeah, he's, Yeah, I think it's not going so well for him. There's also this moment where Tiffany gets Midge some coats. I think it's Tiffany. It does feel like a very Tiffany thing to do.
It has to be Tiffany because they specifically mention Alexis is not there, and I'm assuming the kind of stubborn arsehole is Eva.
Yeah, yeah, that was my read too. And she gets her these fur coats to make sure that she's warm when she's outside, and Midge kind of accepts them in a cute little way. It's very nice. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it also feels like a very Blake thing, you know, a thing early Blake would have done, like treating the other as human rather than, like, you know, just the other help. Yeah. I mean, these two were such a good match. Are a good match? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know whether to use present or past tense on that one. but yeah, I mean, we sort of see how far gone Midge is at this point because she doesn't really acknowledge the niceness of what Tiffany does for her. The only emotion in it is she likes the bit where she scares Tiffany when Tiffany gets too close. Mm. So yeah, like I'm not holding out much hope for a Midge redemption arc at this point. But yeah, in saying that, there's a nice little human moment that her section ends on where she's just sort of happy to be out in the sun. And this is referenced when she's first bound as well. Like she's just kind of happy to be out of the abyss.
Yeah.
Someone like put her somewhere remote, put her in the middle of a desert or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Let her free. Let her live her life. Yeah. So we leave behind Midge and we go and see the birth of a very different kind of other. There is a ritual being conducted that kind of binds and merges different spirits together, giving birth to a greater spirit, a bird spirit.
Yeah, I was so excited when the bird imagery started. I was like, oh, I know who this is, and I can't wait.
Yeah, it's so good. I want to talk about these histories interludes focused on others. I find it so fascinating. Like, one of the best things about Pact, in my opinion, is the world building of it and getting to explore the kind of formative events that create others is so interesting. I really love it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this chapter in particular gives us two great examples.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And two very different types of other being created, which I think is very fun.
I mean, in a way, this Corvidae section almost, like if we're talking about the world building, it gives us more info on spirits than it even does on Corvidae or others.
Yeah.
There's sort of two mechanics that are firmly established in this ritual creating Corvidae that I think we kind of suspected existed, but are properly confirmed here. Which is, one is that it's implied that a god is just like a super spirit or like, you know, a giant group of spirits.
Yeah. I think the line is, that there's no difference between a greater spirit and a lesser god.
Yeah. Or a thin line.
Yeah.
And then also this idea that spirits can kind of join and conglomerate and form, you know, these greater spirits or gods. I actually think that one might have been confirmed earlier. I seem to remember talk of spirits eating each other at one point. I can't remember. Maybe somewhere in Signature, like in Johanna's domain.
I don't recall. If anyone knows what we're talking about, leave it in the discussion question.
But I think the bit here that like really jumped out to me was this talk of how the spirits want to be worshipped. You know, it's talked about as they form the blob, they're fighting for this position which will allow them to be worshipped more. And I mean, it makes sense to tie it into some of my rant from last episode. And what we've already talked about, like if the world is this layer of meaning built on top of chaos and the spirits are the sort of the building blocks of all this meaning and stuff sitting on top of that chaos, attention and reinforcement empowers them and, you know, keeps them even more existing above the chaos that's beneath. And I mean, you know, something like the reinforcement of ideas is something we've seen in just about everything that's not a demon in this story. Like, ideas draw more power from being reinforced over time. They try to create cycles where they perpetuate as well as like propagate. Yeah, it's interesting, although, you know, that we've also seen that, you know, sometimes they get stuck. You get stuck reinforcing not so great ideas, basically.
But that's kind of what gives birth to a specific other with a specific power set, is those are just the ideas that have been reinforced, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, you see something like Conquest, like we get an incarnation, and when they're sort of formed and combined, then they basically go to spread themselves and to, like, you know, empower themselves with even more of the thing that they're an incarnation of. I mean, we do actually, we even see it with demons. They create motes, which are essentially little embodiments of them fucking up the universe, and they perpetuate and propagate their fucking up by spreading out their motes.
It's interesting to me, though, that, like, yeah, everything in the world draws power from attention, right? I think that's a fair kind of, I mean,
yeah,
it's oversimplifying, sort of, yeah, probably, but that seems to be how a lot of it works, right? But then the thing to me that's interesting about that is the place that rule doesn't quite apply is things that go to the abyss, right? Like, Blake went to the abyss and came out stronger and changed and different, right? And that's explicitly because of a lack of attention or a lack of external attention, at least. And I think the same thing applies to Midge. So I'm curious how that fits in then. If attention is what gives you power, how does the abyss fit into that model?
Well, so I think it's sort of what Faisal was talking about. Like, when something like Blake claws back out, the abyss stays with them, and the abyss kind of holds them accountable. They're now forced to spread, like, bits of fear and basically bits of change, bits of chaos. And then that's what the abyss is, right? Is it's closer to that fundamental chaos layer of the universe.
Mm.
So, like, basically things from the abyss are let out by the abyss to sow seeds of, you know, not being calm, I guess. And I mean, there's an interesting, like, paradox there, because also in doing so, they seem to firm the ideas of themselves in the universe and thus become more stable. And also, so simultaneously, they're there to disrupt the system, but they become a part of it.
Mm.
There's a weird, like, disconnect there, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I think this might be where, like, demons and diabolists come in too. Like, demons, you know, they're everything against the system. They're all about breaking the system, and you could use that to destroy, but you can also use that to change. And if we're talking about how the universe gets stuck in these cycles where it's perpetuating and propagating maybe something that isn't great, maybe that's where demons come in, and you can say, hey, that's shit, and break it and try and reinforce something else.
Well, yeah, I guess. But it seeing it as a force for change, I think, is a more positive PR spin on demons than is applicable.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is where Diabolus come in. It's sort of like, you know, how Black Lamb's Blood sort of talked about you know, capturing demons and trying to use them. And I think this is sort of what I'm saying. Like, you want people to direct the demons into destroying things that you don't want to facilitate change. And I mean, it's a big ask, but, you know, what else? I mean, what else are we doing with them? We're just letting them run rampant. Like, is it that bad?
Yeah, you might as well put them to use for something.
Yeah.
So back to to this bird, this corvid, as it were, basically goes around intentionally fucking with people, because it's been given the direction by its creators of basically causing torment to the invaders. And as it does this, it gains more power.
Yeah, and so again, there's that idea of reinforcement right now. The more corvid I fucks with connections, the more powerful he gets in his ability to fuck with connections. So. I'm already sort of seeing this trend being established in this section. And then I wrote this part of my notes before reading your notes directly below. We've pretty much both said the same thing, which is, I mean, this obviously ties into what Blake's going through right now. He's beginning to establish this MO of sympathetic magic, and he's reinforcing that. And how is this going to mirror what Corviday is going through in this section of the chapter?
Well, yeah, because Corviday explicitly... gains more power as he does this. So he starts off as just a bird, and then he notes that he's able to take the form of a child and then eventually an adult. And Corviday, as we know him contemporarily, has taken many different names over the course of his career, I suppose. and so if this is what it looks like for an other to get more powerful, for a boogeyman to get more powerful, what does that look like for Blake? Blake is still in the, you know, he's just the bird at this point. What does the child or the adult version of Blake gain the ability to do? What does he look like?
Yeah, exactly. And how does, I mean, I assume it'll fit into this, as I said, this MO he's establishing of his sympathetic magic. And You know, I don't really have any theories. I'm just so keen to see where it goes, and you know, is Blake ever going to clue into what's bloody happening?
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Knowing Blake, the answer is probably not. So Corviday continues to go around messing with people, basically just fucking with people's lives for fun/power. Not for fun, actually, because he doesn't seem to get joy out of it. He just seems to get satisfaction out of it, I guess.
It's one of the most inhuman POVs we've had. Like, I'd honestly put him up as inhuman as like, in the way they sort of talk about things. Like, because I agree, he's so heartless. It's almost the opposite of what we just had with Midge. Midge was this person doing, or you know, being a victim and you know, this terrible stuff, and you felt so sorry for her. Whereas for Corviday, he's almost so heartless and emotionless that, like, I don't feel sorry for him, and I also don't feel angry at him. I just kind of feel like he's just a force. It's just, that's just him. Like, he's not a human. He's just a thing.
He doesn't seem to have a personality, almost. Although towards the end of the chapter, in fact, at the very end of the chapter, there are a few things that make me second guess that, where he kind of, I don't know. We'll get to that in a moment.
I wonder if as he gets more power, like that's like personality, something that comes alongside with it.
Yeah. Because he did start life as a kind of collection of spirits. Maybe that's something that he just didn't have until he became more established.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, he eventually kind of crosses the wrong family, who bring in a priest who binds him and then bounces him back at his creators. And he basically ends up, well, not killing his creator, although he asks to. He ends up tormenting his creator by doing something unspeakable that we don't ever quite find out what it is, but it seems to be killing a child or killing a loved one.
I got the impression he made someone kill someone else, because there's like a roar and then there's a scream by the same person. So I think maybe he manipulated someone into killing, like, you know, someone they're close to.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's sort of baseless. Mostly baseless speculation. We don't really know. The point is it's unspeakably bad.
Yeah.
And you know, on the topic of sort of Corviday's personality, like, he doesn't... There's nothing in the narration to imply much emotions here, but it's clear he doesn't want to be doing this.
Yes.
Like, to avoid talking about, like, things in terms of personality, because I don't really think he has one yet, it's... this goes against his goals or in his mission. But there is a moment where he tries to call his creator father, and the father just totally, like, Frankensteins on him and dehumanizes him even further, and it's like, don't call me, you know, father, you know, shit creation. That's not exactly what he says, but
it's pretty, paraphrasing. and he doesn't react to it. He doesn't kind of have an emotional reaction to it because he doesn't seem to really have emotions, but you definitely get the vibe that he's, I don't know. I don't want to ascribe emotionality to him when he doesn't have it, but I can kind of feel the disappointment in himself at having to do this.
Yes, it reminds me of how Blake often says, oh, I felt my othery version of fear, or my othery version of, like, pain. And I think Corviday's feeling the very end of the spectrum of that, where he's sort of in a very other way. This is like, he does not like this. And there's no emotion attached to it, but it's a bad thing.
So his creator at this point seems to know he's unleashed a pretty horrible force, and he seems regretful. And it's come back to bite him in a very very specific way. And with his dying energy, he kind of powers up Corviday more, rather than do what I think would be the same thing and try and destroy Corviday and make amends for the problem you've caused. Nope, just double down on it. Power him up.
I don't get the impression this person regrets creating Corviday. He regrets the fact that Corviday has come back.
Yeah, fair.
And I think his dying wish reinforces that read.
spiteful.
Yeah,
spiteful.
Yes, and I mean, like, he really speaks to Corviday's nature with that ending, where he empowers him not to, like, break the seal or anything, because they don't think they're powerful enough to do that, but it's like, just, here's another avenue for you to cause more pain against the people who use you.
Yep.
Which is obviously something we're going to get to talk about in a bit.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, the creator basically sacrifices himself and gives Corviday 9 years of his life, of practitioner energy, which is enough for Corviday to be able to fuck over people who summon him. And I kind of feel bad for Corviday. Like, he is, you're right, he's a force. He's a force that is explicitly created by somebody spiteful in order to get revenge, and he does, and then he kind of ends up having to just kind of be in this world and cause more pain and suffering, and he starts enjoying it, which is a little bit horrifying, but I think that that's kind of the point of this chapter, is Midge and Corviday are both others that are explicitly created and just kind of serve to be a tool and a weapon now because they just had, you know, horrible inciting incidents that have caused them to now be, exist in this world.
Yeah, well, you don't really blame either of them for where they've ended up. I mean, Midge is, like, you know, a product of her circumstance and hasn't really had an opportunity to get better, as we said. And Corviday was literally made to be what he is, so it's hard to hold it against him. It's like hating a clock for telling the time.
Yeah.
So
the moral of this
and
interlude...
And I mean, yeah, that's really what all...
Sorry.
Sorry?
Yeah, you continue.
I was just going to say, you know, that's really what all these history interludes do, right? Is
yeah.
they make me understand and sympathize with just about anyone or anything even.
Yeah. I think the moral of this interlude is, who are the real monsters? Who are the real others, Elliot? Did you ever think about that? Huh?
I mean, yeah, pretty much. I mean, humans have a sort of special place in this world, but they're still part of this world, so they're still just as shit as the rest of it.
Well, no, it's worse, though, because humans are, and practitioners are, the forces that have explicitly created these others. Corviday exists in the world to cause pain because a human said, I'm going to make something to exist to cause pain. Like, that's shit.
Yeah, no, you're right. Whereas, and Midge similarly was created by shit people.
Yeah.
And then summoned back into the world to be used as a force for bad things by other shit people. Yeah.
And obviously, you can't really hold it against Blake and Co. for wanting things to defend themselves with, but they are using these others, right? They are explicitly summoning these others to use them to make things shit for something. The things that are attacking them, yes, but, you know. So, Corviday basically is back. He's back in business and he just keeps fucking things up. And he eventually finds his way to a crone who has kidnapped some of his playthings.
Yes. Ultimate team up. So ready for these two.
And I want to talk about how Corviday notes that he's taken a power hit from making this bigger play, but is able to recuperate. And I'm kind of curious. Do we think Blake can do this too, or do we think this is something that Corviday can only do because he now is bound by the Seal of Solomon? Like, is that what it is that allows him to kind of recuperate energy over time? Because it doesn't seem that Blake is able to do that without spooking people.
Yeah, I think that might be the difference right there, is because Blake's from the Abyss, that's one of his ways. I think also my impression is that Corviday doesn't just recuperate it from doing nothing, but it's out, you know, like I think it's like a sort of min-maxing situation where he maybe spent more like power to mess them up than maybe he should have, like you know, he could have done it for less. So you can recuperate power by making more of an impact by, you know, doing less and spending less energy. So you can, he's like, his way of recuperating it is just being more efficient in the way he ruins people's lives. And so, you know, maybe, you know, for Blake, it's like he's got to spook people or something. And when he terrifies people or has an impact, that's when he gets some power. And it's all about being as efficient as you can when you do that.
Yeah, I guess not jumping out of the mirror or sticking birds into things. Just taking it easy and spooking people from the mirrors for a bit.
Yeah, or making sure that when you know, do stick yourself out of the mirror or, you know, use some sympathetic magic, it's as impactful as possible.
Or maybe he just needs to figure out that actually making people laugh is about 10 times as efficient as making them scared, and then he'll be fine. Yeah.
Did he even watch Monsters?
I know, right?
Come on, Blake.
God, Blake, get with the program. Corviday and Mara basically form a simple friendship and start to bond before she hacks off her own foot and takes the body of a child.
So quick thing, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but Corviday promises here that he's going to bring Mara something that he's taking from the people who summon him each time he visits. And we later learn that he's apparently nicked the Conquest mirror?
Yes, either taken it or hidden it somewhere. It's a little unclear, yeah. But either way, it's
bad. I'm wondering if he's given it to Mara. That could be a fun / horrible development.
That's true. My favorite part of this is Corviday asks, where do the children come from? And Mara's response is, the question is where the men come from, which is horrifying. Like, it's like, that's a two-sentence horror story right there.
Yeah, it's such a good response. And you're right, you just sort of like, that's a good point. And it raises so many more questions. Yep. And I'm so much more terrified of the responses.
Yeah. Also, it's worth pointing out, Grin Vader, who left a comment on the 11.7 chapter, is proven right here. Mara is perpetuating herself by sticking herself into children, and then the children go into the dolls. So, good work.
Yeah, yeah, spot on. Well done. To finish this section off, Corviday mentions that the couple have gone and settled in the nearest town to Mara, which is presumably Jacob's Bell. So, like, I was trying to figure out, do we know this couple? Because I think it's the same kids. It's like the kid with the drunk dad who was a liar, and the girl who was like the son of someone important, who was, you know, very innocent or whatever, and he sort of got them together. And I think it's that same couple. So I was trying to think of anyone who fits that bill, and nothing's jumped out at me yet. But I wonder if, well, because Corviday specifically sort of mentions, you know, that Mara will see that this is not a good thing that he's put them back in play. So I can't wait to. I wonder if that is something we're going to see.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it could be, obviously the worst interpretation would be it's the ancestors of a Thorburn or a Behame or a Duchamp or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing I could think of was like Rose and Blake's parents, but they didn't quite fit for a number of reasons. Yeah. Maybe Aunt Irene or something. I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't really fit. Everyone I've thought of so far, it doesn't fit with, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe we'll get some more clues towards it later in the story.
Yeah.
So we jump forward and Corviday is summoned by the Thorburns and he comes and they say to him, fuck shit up. And he goes, yes, sir. But of course, secretly he is planning on ways that he can fuck them over in exchange. And of course he already has in a number of ways.
Yes. I love this guy. Such a creepy mofo.
Yeah. Yeah, the reveal that Corviday has fucked with Conquest's binding is pretty scary. And it kind of points out that Rose has said, or I think it was Alexis who said that Rose is more on top of the bleed through than Conquest from Conquest than Blake was implying. But this kind of counteracts that and says, no, maybe not. Be careful, Rose, basically.
Yes, I mean, this implies that there's a bit more going on than Rose was aware of. Yeah. Yeah, like as I said, I think he's maybe put the mirror somewhere or like either given it to someone or made it get lost and maybe tampered with it, as he said. So can't wait to see as we get to understand more about what's happening there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's also this bit where he talks about how he has a lock of black hair and it seems to be connected to what he's talked about with the Conquest thing. And of course, that makes you think, oh, well, Conquest was bound using some hair, but that was Rose's hair, and she's blonde, so it's not that. I'm there's something else going on here, and it's hard to put your finger on what it is.
No, that discrepancy stood out to me as well, because I was like, oh, yeah, wait, no, it's not blonde. And so thinking on it more, like, I guess the only thing I've come up with is, has his and Mara's relationship perhaps gone further? Like, how long ago was that scene that we saw? I'm wondering if this lock of Mara's hair is maybe, you know, representative of something a ring is traditionally used for. Which would, again, strengthen the idea that he's given the mirror to Mara. So that's the best idea I've got right now, is he's in some sort of relationship with Mara.
He's married a crone. Yeah, I could see that. I don't know. Maybe. Who knows? We go to our last point of view character, our shortest point of view, and it's Green Eyes, and she's happily relaxing in the water before Blake calls her to the house to fight alongside them, and she enthusiastically jumps on board with any opportunity to help her husbando, Blake.
I mean, I love that we end with this, like, nice positive pick-me-up. I think this chapter's, like, pretty full-on and heavy, because like Corviday and Midge are both pretty horrifying existences.
Yeah.
So it's really nice that, you know, we immediately switch to Green Eyes and immediately you just perk up. Like, her first very short little segment just ends with, once she recognizes the voice, it's just a one-word paragraph that's just Blake.
Yeah.
With an exclamation mark, and you're just like, oh, this is so nice.
Yeah, she's very happy to be useful to Blake. She's obviously quite keen. I like the line, green eyes, she's being summoned and she thinks a light flashed. She didn't wait for it to take form as a door or whatever, which is, I just found that, like, that's like a very hilarious line by Green Eyes.
Yeah, yeah, I do. I really enjoy her narration style in this segment. It's so much more chill and fun. Yeah.
Interestingly, she comes out of the bathtub and she talks about how she is enjoying the sound of the town bell, which is, I don't know, scary. I don't know what it's hinting at, but I don't think it's good.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been implied that the bell is kind of, you know, getting everyone's engines revving, right?
Yeah. So
maybe because she's not tied to the abyss in the normal kind of, you know, evilish way, maybe it just gets her keen. I don't know. I guess we'll see where that goes. I agree. There's a number, like, as much as I enjoy the really positive vibe of this part of the chapter, there's a number of question marks raised in various bits.
Yeah. Like when Green Eyes refers to Evan as the bird morsel.
That's a red herring, I think, because Wobbo couldn't possibly do that to us.
No, I agree. I think that would be a bit too intense for this story. Even that would be too much. So there's an interesting bit where Blake and Peter are talking, and this is through Green Eyes' perspective. So Green Eyes sees Peter as Blake's relative, who says, and they're talking about how Peter was jealous of Blake, and Peter says, Blake asks, what were you jealous of? And Peter says, I don't know, Paige, Molly, and then Blake says, me? And then we don't really get an answer to that because the house starts
where
being
things
sieged.
End.
But it's, I don't know why Blake thinks that, because he didn't exist when they were younger. So I don't understand what Blake is asking here.
I think there's like, because it's because of the way Peter sort of pauses, and there's like, I get the impression Peter's just sort of gets stuck in this weird mental loop, because, I mean, I've been assuming that, you know, like, I've sort of talked about my theory that we had Rose and Blake was carved out of her. Now I'm back to thinking, was Blake the original and Rose was carved out of him? Which seems like a weird theory to have, because that was pretty much our working assumption for the first half of the book. It doesn't really feel like any cutting edge theory crafting. But yeah, I mean, I guess the only difference would be that they're both other from what we saw in the first half of the book. It seems like this will be the start of the process of Blake realizing that there's more, or exactly what else is going on here with him and Rose.
We'll have to keep track of that as we go, I suppose. And that's the end of the chapter. But let's talk about it as a whole, because there are three different perspectives here. And the way that I kind of interpreted this is, the first two perspectives are obviously quite long, and they have a lot of things in common, whereas Green Eyes' one, the third one, is quite short. And this kind of made me think about, well, what do the first two have in common, and how can we extrapolate that out into making inferences about Green Eyes? So, for example, Midge went against Rose when she was first summoned. Corviday clearly goes against the people who summon him, and now Green Eyes has been summoned by Blake. So maybe that's indicating something. Or here's another one. Midge's story features people being chained up and eaten. Corviday's story features people being chained up and going to be eaten. And Green Eyes' story, I don't know, we'll see.
I reject both of these hypotheses. on purely emotional grounds.
Sure.
For me, the sort of difference that stood out was the tone and the sort of nature of their backstories. Like, I sort of tied all of these to Blake. Like, I guess that's usually what I sort of do with these interludes, is look at what it's saying about, like, what our main characters are going through.
Mm.
And I think they all tie to Blake in interesting and different ways. Like, we already talked about, like, Midge and how she came. Like, she kind of comes from a broken family. She's kind of like Blake, ran away / got kicked out. But, you know, she started out as not quite human, not quite other, maybe. And obviously, you know, who knows exactly what happened to Blake before the story started, yeah, or what Blake existed. But, you know, like, I think there's maybe some interesting connections there discussing the levels of humanity, I think. Like, you know, I think that's really what Midge's part of the chapter was covering, was, you know, the various ideas of the blurry line between human and other. And then we have a Corviday, who obviously had, you know, has the bird imagery, hampered freedom. And I think more than anything, maybe this is just the way I focus, but this was like a very mechanical, like we learned a lot about spirits and their motivations, which I think feeds into the fact that Blake now uses his sympathetic magic. But they both of those two sections paint pretty bleak images for where Blake is going. Cause neither of those two have ended up in particularly great places. And, you know, like, even Corviday started as something that was trying to fight the invasion of like, you know, European stuff, which I think probably came along with a lot of the Seal of Solomon stuff. So, you know, Corviday represents a sort of attempt to fight against that system, and it has obviously worked out. And then I think this all sort of comes together with Green Eyes, and I'm taking a more positive spin. I'm taking a more positive spin and saying Green Eyes represents a good thing. You know, Blake has pulled her out of the abyss, and she's going to do good, and it's like evidence of a good thing, because we've heard so much in this story about how Blake wanted to do good things for the world, and hopefully Green Eyes is going to get to stand as an example of something good that he did.
Yeah, hopefully. I like the idea of each of these people representing something about Blake. The battle between human and others from Midge, and the kind of battle between freedom and being, you know, a tool, I guess, for Corviday. I wonder what we're meant to infer about Green Eyes from this, though. That's the part that really gets to me, is that they obviously are intentional choices of the things to be summoned here. Corviday seems to be relatively plot important, but Midge, it didn't have to be Midge that was summoned to help defend them here.
I'm choosing to view the Green Eyes section as hope, basically. Okay. The idea that there can be good parts to this, and Blake can be a part of those parts.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. And of course, that brings us to the end of Malfeasance as an arc. So let's talk about Malfeasance. Malfeasance means wrongdoing, especially by a public official. And the question that of course begs is, who's the public official in this case? And I think the closest thing we have is the council, right?
Yeah. That's a pretty solid. A solid one. I mean, also, you know, Blake is currently going to war with the system as a whole. I don't think it necessarily applies specifically to individuals, but, like, you know, I think Blake's basically arguing that this entire system from the ground up is malfeasance. Obviously, Blake also breaking the rules as somebody who's aware of the world and bringing his cousins in is maybe another interpretation. I guess we'll see how it goes.
I don't know how much of a public official Blake is, but it is, I think, wrongdoing, at the very least.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the themes from this arc. And I think the big one to me, and one that was really reinforced this interlude, is the idea of humanity, especially the humanity of others. Because that's really what Blake has been struggling with, and we see it throughout the arc with things like the paper girl, or kind of different examples of what humanity or lack of humanity looks like in these characters, right? We have Rose and the Thorburns and Andy and Ava and the others from this interlude, and they all exhibit different levels of what I would call humanity, right? Where Andy and Ava are kind of cold or not empathetic. The Thorburns are kind of hot and cruel. Rose can be calculating, and these others are, I mean, each has their own different aspect of humanity. And I think that these are kind of presented throughout this arc as different avenues, I guess, for Blake to go down. And maybe the one I excluded here is Evan, who is probably the most human of all the characters, except probably maybe Alexis and Tiffany and stuff. These are the avenues for Blake to possibly go down, and especially in this interlude, these are the ways that Blake could end up. I think that's a big question that this arc is wrangling with, is what does Blake look like when he finally settles somewhere in between human and boogeyman?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that that's really a theme that's carried on from Arc 10. Like, we talked about that a lot in Arc 10 as well.
Yeah.
This idea of, like, Blake finding his footing in the spectrum of human to other, basically.
Yeah.
For want of a better term.
To kind of extend that as well, like, this is the arc where Blake takes on a new identity publicly as the Thorburn Boogeyman, right? Like, he presents himself to Ava as the Thorburn Boogeyman. He's not Blake now. He is the Thorburn Boogeyman. And that's an interesting blend of Thorburn obviously has connotations in this story with the Thorburns, and then Boogeyman obviously is a way to define himself. And so he's kind of interestingly pigeonholed himself into a place somewhere between being an asshole Thorburn and a kind of spooky boogeyman, which I like.
Yeah. But I think to extend this idea of humanity being a theme, I think something we've talked about a lot in Arc 11 and the book as a whole, I guess, is not just that humanity, but how that's a product of your origins. And that beat, we've obviously hit that very hard in this interlude. We've talked about that a lot, like a lot looking at the time on this recording. But, like, you know, as Blake has been targeting the system, he's been talking about, like, you know, we had the chat with the junior council. We talked about, like, the Bahames. Like, so much of this is, you know, how people's circumstances affect their personality and their, you know, humanity to so many degrees. Like, it, you know, it's about your circumstance. And the Thorburns coming in. I mean, obviously, you know, we've talked a lot in this arc since the Thorburns were introduced about how they're teaching us a lot about why Blake and Rose are like what they're like.
So
I think that's also something that's been addressed in this arc quite heavily.
I think the other thing
this arc has talked about a lot is the spirits and their sort of motivations. Like, I guess this isn't really a theme, but, like, I think more than any arc since the spirits were very introduced in Arc 2, like, from the very beginning, this is really kind of taught us more about spirits and how they work. Like, I think, like, I will quite always kind of remember this arc for teaching us so much more about the spirits and how they operate, and it feels like we're heading towards the end game in that regard.
I mean, this arc kind of opened up with Blake forming a connection with Lefty, one of the spirits that is inhabiting his body, and since then kind of figuring out how they respond to him. So you're right, I think exploring the mechanics of the spirits is something that is going to become more and more necessary as Blake leans on them more and more, I suppose.
Yeah. So it's just something I feel like this arc has explored so much more than the rest of the story combined, even.
Yeah. And that's the end. That's the end of Arc 11. But don't worry, there's still a few more arcs left in this story. Next up is Duress, which sounds like it'll be a fun time for all involved.
Oh, God.
If you have
They're thoughts- not going to get out of this house. It's going to be a whole arc of the house being fucking invaded, isn't it?
Yeah. If you have thoughts on this interlude or any of the stuff we've been talking about, or your thoughts on what you think the themes of this arc as a whole have been, the best place to leave those are in the discussion thread, which we will link down below.
Yes, you can also find us on Twitter, at MediaMDPodcast. You know, so make sure you go and do you follow, subscribe? How does
follow
it work on Twitter?
Is the word. You've been tweeting now for months. You haven't learned the nomenclature?
No, I just hop on there and do the live reads and hop off. And speaking of, those should be starting, I think, about just over a week from when this episode comes out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, make sure you follow us so you'll see when those start up again.
Yep, right now we're both in Melbourne playing a lot of video games, but we'll get back to doing live reads and resuming regularly scheduled broadcasts soon.
Yes. Of course, if you want to hear more about Doof Media, it's a network that Deep Impact is on, and there's a bunch of other great shows, doofmedia.com. It's the place to do it.
Yes. Actually, the Doofcast has just released an episode on the Taika Waititi film Hunt for the Wilder People, which is a really heartwarming and beautiful movie. We talked about it on Media MD, so they kind of stealing our ideas a little bit, but that's okay. We're all a friendly network. We'll let them steal our ideas if we want to. I mean, it's not like we'd ever steal their ideas of a show or anything.
Yeah.
It's not like we'd steal the format of doing a deep chapter by chapter dive into a Wild West story.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, absolutely. But Hunt for the Wilder People, it is a great film. So definitely, like, go watch it and then tune into the Doofcast about it, maybe even the Meteor MD if you're so inclined.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely worth a look. It's a fantastic movie. I'd say it's Taika Waititi's best film, and that's counting What We Do in the Shadows and Thor 3.
He's actually, I have to go see Jojo Rabbit, which is, I think, just come out, hasn't it? It's meant to be pretty good as well.
Yes, I'm not sure exactly when it comes out, but yeah, I do want to see that one. Anyway, if you love the Doofcast, yep. Deep Impact, all the other shows on the Doof Media Network, head to patreon.com/doofmedia and support us in any way you can, because it helps keep the network afloat and keeps all these shows running.
Yep, of course, if you can't support us monetarily, that's okay too. Just share the news on the show, that would be great. Get more people into PACT and get more people into Deep Impact as a result. Or if you are looking for another organization/entity/individual to support, may I recommend Wildbo himself. He also has a Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo, where you can donate to him for writing all the great stories that you and us and he presumably also enjoy.
I mean, yeah, like, do you want them to stop? Of course you don't.
Yeah, so, come on.
You know, go help him out.
What's wrong with you?
Yes, so apart from that, we'll be back for Duress 12.1 on Wednesday, the 9th of October.
Bye.